Bishop, Ms. Montani, Ms. Graham. I think it's the 8th official visit that we've done in the last 5 years, and tomorrow will be the 4th time that I've gone officially to the downtown east side. It's very odd to sort of put these words like official in front, but it's the same reason that you're asked to stand up and people say, His Excellency. It's interesting in this most egalitarian of countries that since 1848, there are really only two people in the country that you're ever asked to stand up for. And that's the Governor General and the other half of the Governor General. And the reassuring thing is you only have to do it for them for 5 years, and then they have to stand up for the next people. And they go from being Excellency to John, or back to being John. And I think that that's a very interesting thing, because it's a reminder of the astonishing stability of the country. It's a sort of small focus on the stability of the country. Everybody who knows me knows that I love coming to Vancouver. I think that this is a city which always knew it was going to be the cutting-edge city of Canada. It was convinced it was, perhaps a little before it actually was. But I think for the last 10 years, for those of us who know the city and love it, you could actually see it, you know, in one of those horse races, just galloping up to the front of the pack and getting past the others. I actually think that, you know, when I want to know what's happening in Canada and where the risks are being taken, where the original things are being tried out, some of them are going to be great successes, some of them are going to be failures, some of them are going to be, who knows, but it's happening in Vancouver. I think this is really a very, very exciting city and a very exciting time for this city. There are amazing debates here on political issues, on social issues. There's amazing culture here. It's quite a remarkable place. I mean, Canada is a city which has done quite well with its cities compared to a number of other places. But I just think that this is, you know, this is the second wave of provinces to come into Confederation almost immediately after Confederation. But I think now Vancouver and probably British Columbia is becoming the province and the city which is going to show the way. The history of Canada is really that the energy seems to move around. There are, you know, 10, 20 years it'll be Quebec and then it'll be Nova Scotia. And you can sort of say, public education was really Joseph Howe, Nova Scotia, or women's rights, but it was really Manitoba and Alberta. Foreign policy, but it was really, you know, Manitoba and Quebec. And I think that the next little while is going to be BC, and I think and very much Vancouver. So it's when you come here to talk about something which is both very strong and fundamental and yet in some ways fragile, you know you're in a city where people are really talking about it and are willing to come out and talk about it. I read your article this morning, and I jokingly, your article, where are you, Ms. Montani? And jokingly, in your paper, and got to get it right. and jokingly said, now that you've given my speech, I'll have to give another speech. But actually, you freed me to think about some other things this morning, so I really rethought it all. So I want to sort of do this in a slightly unusual way. First of all, let me begin with a little bit of history, which is perhaps not unusual for me, but, you know, we always handicap our ability to deal with issues in Canada by talking about what a new country this is. And there are a whole bunch of things that are new. I mean, the waves of immigration mean that there's always something new and give us the impression that it's new, and the fact that we haven't dealt with some major issues in the country mean that it's new. But on the other hand, we've actually been at it. Europeans have been working together and with or not with the Aboriginals for over 400 years. That's a long time. And we are, in fact, I think it's worth just saying this, we are, in fact, probably the second oldest continual unbroken democracy in the world. And we're probably the oldest unbroken democratic federation in the world. So we're talking about a society and a country which has an amazing political and social experience. It denies that it has it all the time. We always pretend that we've just started and it's a real mess. But we seem to know what to do with our messes. We sort of mess our way through them and are surprised that it comes out somewhere at the end. Doesn't mean we're not fragile. Everybody's fragile. But we've been at this for a very long time, long enough to believe that there is something called the Canadian collective unconscious, which has to do with political will, which has to do with what the nature of shared values are, which has to do with avoiding crises which will destroy us, but also knowing how to humble people who think they can push us around inside the country. Outside, it's a little more complicated. Really, you know, since 1848, since Elgin, LaFontaine, and Baldwin, we have been a functioning democracy, 1848, 1867, 1871 BC. It's all very linked, and it's all part of an unbroken line. And I say this to you because one of the things about democracy is it's not Jacobism. It's not fascism. It's not Bolshevism. It's not about enormous explosive changes of direction. It's actually, you know, there's always that terrible cliche about, you know, what was it? It's the worst system except for all the others, which I've never thought was a very good way of putting it. I always like to say that it's the most boring system of government in the world, which is its glory. It's the most wasteful. It takes the most time. It's the opposite of efficient. It's all about talking. Otherwise, why would you be here? You know, and it's not efficient. If you want efficiency, get a dictator. You know, it'll work for 10 years or so. If you don't know how to waste time, you can't really have a democracy. So it's about a kind of solid inching forward on a track. And it's about building something called civilization, which is based on an understanding of your experiences and therefore memory. Experience and memory and therefore stability. And that mattress of experience and memory and stability, that enormous mattress, you know, with second oldest, means you've got this great big solid mattress that you can really jump up and down on and do original things with. You can do it in the marketplace, you can do it with policy, providing you're staying on the line. If you go off the line, you're in deep trouble. But you can sort of stay within a in fourchette, in marge de manoeuvre, you know, a margin of maneuver, providing you stay on the mattress and understand that that is the stability, that's the foundation upon which you're working. And I say this because countries cannot do anything they want. That's one of the problems with international ideologies, international truths, is it leaves people with the impression that they can, oh, we all have to do this because everybody else is doing it. Well, the reality is that countries have truths about themselves. Some things they share internationally, some things are inescapable, fundamental to their place. November without a raincoat in Vancouver, I mean, you know, a form of lunacy. Right? As is, you know, Nunavut in January without a coat, a very warm coat, a form of lunacy. Those are basic physical truths, but there are truths and conditions which are fundamental to every country. And if we've survived this long, it's because we have some understanding of what those truths and conditions are. And what you have to do is you have to understand that you grow upon your understanding of the fundamental truths, and you attempt as you go along, you know, moving along. I'm changing images. One's jumping up and down on a mattress, and the other's going down this rather narrow road where you can go a bit over this way and a bit over that way. So excuse me for mixing the two, but I think you can deal with it. And what you're trying to do as you're moving along is you're trying to eliminate the weaknesses and the errors and strengthen what works. Find out more and more about yourself. It's a sort of purification, right? But you never end up pure. So what are the fundamental truths about Canada? Well, there are lots of them, you know. Again, in spite of Victorian Vancouver, the greatest and most fundamentally northern country in the world. After all, the rest of British Columbia understands that, and I think you just have to give in to what they know on this issue. A country which used to be totally dependent on commodities, in spite of our smartness, by which I mean, you know, urban smartness, still is about 30% dependent on commodities. If you remove that, we're bankrupt. So we must never, never forget the central role and all the dangers and difficulties and instabilities that can come with commodity, dependency on commodities if you don't pay attention. And immigration. Aboriginal people were here, but from the arrival of the first Europeans, apart from the Aboriginals, this has been a country of immigrants, whether you've been here for 450 years or 300 or 200 or last week. And that those three things are perhaps key to the kind of country that this has to be. And what's come out of that is an understanding of how fragile and difficult it is to live in such a large landmass, with so many geographical difficulties, with such difficult climate, with basically an island, as a friend of mine always says, you know, we have the longest seacoast in the world, and then we have this fourth thing, which is actually a form of seacoast, in a way, because it's about how do you sail the sailing ship along a relationship with the most powerful country in the history of the world. Our closest and dearest friends, providing we can maintain a certain distance. We've been working at this for a very long time. We know how to do it. Too close one way, too far the other way, we're in trouble. So out of that comes, right the way through, an understanding of a certain kind of need for government involvement. It's always been true and it remains true. An understanding of complexity which is not at all understood in European countries or even in our neighbor to a great extent. An understanding that this has never been a monolithic culture, it's always been a non-monolithic culture. A consciousness that slipping off that mattress or off route could lead to the kind of instability which would send us back into the poverty in which we wallowed for a very long time. Never forget that emigration from Canada was greater than immigration to Canada in almost every year of our history until well into the 20th century. This is not a naturally rich country, it's a naturally poor country. We've made it rich by being careful about what we can do here, by understanding the nature of our democracy. So instability leads to poverty. Risky changes of direction lead to poverty. Stability leads to a strengthening of citizenship. Citizenship is all about understanding that the public good comes first, and that the public good, if solid and well handled, will lead to wealth. But the wealth doesn't produce the public good or citizenship. It's the public good that produces wealth. All of that, I guess you could summarize as the Canadian idea of a middle class society. No matter how poor we were, our immigrants, unlike immigrants to other countries, our immigrants somehow were always convinced that they were middle class. I don't know where it came from. I think I can trace it through to various spots. But there's a sort, and it's not the European bourgeois tradition at all. It's an idea of properness and middle classness, which some people think makes us doubly boring, democratic and middle class, but actually makes us very interesting and clever and devious risk takers within the limits of what you can do. After all, we invented the idea of the non-monolithic society. We're so far ahead of the pack in terms of experimenting with the non-monolithic society. I've just come from a meeting in Europe where I silenced a room filled with leading European figures with a series of phrases that had to, which in Canada would have just been greeted with, well, of course. And so we just don't realize how far ahead of the pack we are. And yet, it is a continuation of what we've been doing for a couple of centuries, as we've gradually eliminated our terrible errors and our elements of terrible racism and exclusion and gradually understood how to do this. And what we're doing is, you know, we talk about, we're descended from British parliamentary democracy. I've always thought that was nonsense. I can't think of a country more different from Britain than this country. They are monolithic, they have an idea of a mythology, they have great difficulty with difference of serious difference of group approaches, one language, a little bit of immigration, a lot of argument about it. And I could say the same thing about our relationship with France and with the United States. We're much more different than we realize, and that's why it's important to understand the history, understand the experience and the memory. So the heart of Canadian stability, citizenship, the middle class myth, what is it? Well, I always believed that it was public education. I believe that it's public education because if you look at the rise of democracy in Canada, you'll find, and this is not true of other democracies, you'll find that the very people who were the frontline people, including in British Columbia, in favor of democracy, responsible government, whatever you want to call it, were the same people who were struggling for public education. So that we became a democracy as we became a society in which public education was dominant in a way that it is not dominant in Britain, in a way, curiously enough, that it is not dominant in France. Certainly not, it's the way it was intended to be dominant in the United States, but didn't work out that way. Adrian Montani quoted me this morning, quoting the introduction to the British Columbia 1872 School Act. And I think it's worth re-quoting that, if I may, because that's, you know, that's a long time ago. And it said, the purpose of public education is to give every child in the province such knowledge as will fit him, her, they didn't quite know about that, to become a useful, you think utilitarian, but no, a useful and intelligent citizen. The noun is citizen. The key point is citizen. And the origins of that argument, where did it come from? 1840, the beginning of Canadian democracy, Louis Lafontaine, in the basic document of Canadian democracy, which is therefore not studied or read anywhere, the address to the electors of Terrebonne, Address aux électeurs de Terrebonne, said, among many wonderful things, l'éducation est le premier bienfait qu'un gouvernement puisse conférer à un peuple. Education is the first public good that a government can confer upon a people. Baldwin, his sidekick in the creation of democracy, 1843, the first big debate about public education in Upper Canada, 160-something years ago, about taxation, which is central to this issue. It is surely the rich man who will particularly, he's trying to figure out how to get them to pay taxes. Yeah. It is surely the rich man who will particularly benefit by the people being educated. And surely those who are so fortunate as to belong to the favored class could not be so narrow-minded and so blind to their own interests as to object to being taxed to this effect, to support this great and important object. Joseph Howe, 1848, father of democracy in the Maritimes. If you were my brother, I would not permit your interests to weigh a feather against a trust so sacred as I believe our public school system to be. And then this is very interesting. Wilmot, conservative leader in New Brunswick, one of the fathers of Confederation, in 1852, says, it is the public education is the right of the child. That's very interesting. It's very modern. It is the duty not only of the parent, you know, this is the thing, should people who don't have children pay? Should everybody pay? It is the duty not only of the parent, but of the people. The property of the country, which is to say those who have the money, the property of the country should educate the country. All are interested in the diffusion of that intelligence which conserves the peace and promotes the well-being of society. The rich man is interested in proportion to his riches and should contribute most to the maintenance of schools. This is a conservative, by the way. In those days, you know, the tax collector went around with a bell. I want to hear the tax collector for schools calling at my door. That amazing pride that the middle class should feel that they are known to be paying as many taxes as are necessary as to ensure universal public education. A very important thing.